Haseeb Hussein Zada was an immigrant to the U.S. from Afghanistan in 2011, and he's a practicing Muslim. Because of his cultural and language background, he decided to join the U.S. Army. But then he started basic training.
There is a mentality when kids join the army or the military in general that we're going to go and kill Muslims. That's what I heard. And so there was this kid at basic training that like, dude, I cannot wait to go out in the world and start killing Muslims.
Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, a conversation about unexpected minorities serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. Examining the issue historically and in present day, why have immigrants and ethnic minorities served, and what barriers do they continue to face in trying to serve and protect their country? That conversation is coming up, but first this. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. From the Revolutionary War to the Civil War, from World War I until today, America has a deep and long history of immigrants serving in the United States Armed Forces. Today, immigrants account for about 13% of the total U.S. population, and that percentage is about the same in the U.S. Armed Forces. Throughout history, Native Americans, African Americans, Japanese Americans, and Hispanics have all served, but also have people from different religions other than Christianity. And increasingly today, many in the Armed Forces are LGBT. These millions of other, quote, unexpected minorities serving in the U.S. military today is the subject of today's Hinckley Forum. This discussion was recorded this past week before the Veterans Day weekend. Matt Basso is an associate professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah, and he served as moderator.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much for coming out. This is one of a series of events that the university holds to acknowledge and mark Veterans Day in particular. This year, of course, that falls on a Saturday. I'm hopeful that you'll have a chance to make some of the other events. The information has been fairly widely circulated, but if you have any questions, we can let you know when those events are. As Hope noted, I'm an associate professor of history and gender studies, and I was delighted to be invited to moderate this panel. I myself am a veteran of the early post-Cold War. I think I just made that term up. And I was in ROTC during my college years, and hence my service. I was in the United States Army from 1990 to 1994, primarily in Germany, in Europe. I was then an intelligence officer and also worked at the Army Europe's Air Assault School with the 11th Armored Cavalry Regiment. So I might bring up some of that history a little bit later, but I'm more enthused to talk to our panelists today about the experience of communities of color, of what we've termed here as unexpected minorities, an interesting term in its own right, in the United States military. The context for this conversation is, of course, our present moment, and the tensions surrounding the place of diverse Americans, not just in our polity, but in the U.S. military, the policies of our government, the way our society comes to terms with what it means both to serve for anyone and what it means to serve if you're from a community of color or a community that's been marginalized in some other way. Most certainly, the way we often interpret that is through the experience of Muslim Americans and Arab Americans of other religious backgrounds in the contemporary moment. But as I'll tell you in a couple of minutes, the history of unexpected minorities, the history of communities of color, of folks who have sometimes been deemed enemy aliens, and their service in the U.S. military is much deeper than just this present moment. And to understand that history, I think, is to understand the long-term tensions over service in the military and the profound patriotism of communities in the United States who constantly see themselves marginalized by fellow citizens, which is the tragedy of this story, but also, I think, an enabling part of it as well. So we will get into that, but first let me introduce these folks and give you a chance to know a little bit about them. Sanu Bhatti, who goes primarily by Singh, just sitting to my left, your farthest right, is a computer science student here at the U. He immigrated from India as a child and served in the Army Infantry from 2001 and 2000 through 2005. Hasib Husseinzada, who's next to Singh, is a student at Westminster College. He also was an immigrant to the United States and currently is serving in the United States Army. And next to Hasib is Diane Akiyama. Apologize for that. She's assistant counsel with the United States Bar. Her father served in Europe during World War II in arguably one of the most famous units in the history of the United States, the 442 Regimental Combat Team, which was made up of Japanese-American servicemen, many of whom had been interned, and we'll say a little bit more about the 42nd a little bit later. Okay, I'm going to give you a chance to ask questions in a couple of minutes, but I do want to set the context for this historically, and then I want to ask our panelists to talk a little bit about some of the major themes that we're going to be working through as we go along. So this question of unexpected minorities, a term that, again, doesn't trip off the tongue, could encompass an enormous number of groups in United States history. But let's start with the first, American Indians, right? Native Americans have an incredibly long history of service in the United States Armed Forces. And, of course, they served in many instances under a category that could easily be included as enemy aliens, right? A remarkable history of service when the United States Army in the 19th century was at war against many Native American nations. Many of you know that Native Americans did not receive citizenship rights till the 20th century, and yet they served. Many of you, of course, know that they're among the most marginalized communities in the United States today by poverty rates and other means, and yet they're also among the highest by per capita percentage of men and women who serve in the United States military, right? This is an important topic, one that was covered by a recent panel just like this, I believe just last year, as part of the University of Utah's Veterans Day ceremonies. African Americans, of course, have, again, another long, proud history of service in the United States military and have just as long, if not longer, history of facing prejudice and oppression in our society. African Americans have not been able to serve in a desegregated military until 1948, when finally that was lifted. So in World War I, in World War II, and in the wars that came before that. In addition, of course, African Americans continue to face the same sort of hostility that they often see in day-to-day life in the United States. The same thing goes to a different extent for Latina and Latino soldiers who have faced that hostility but have an incredibly long history of service in the United States military. We're going to talk about the experience of Japanese Americans in particular, but more broadly, Asian American and Pacific Islanders have a long history of service and also a long history of facing discrimination in the broader United States context. In the case of Pacific Islanders, they, like Native Americans, are among the highest per capita enlistees in the United States military today. So some really pretty remarkable stories there as well. This form of unexpected minority service also should be categorized or thought through in regard to religion. while the United States is a society built on religious tolerance, we don't necessarily see those principles followed through, either by policy or otherwise, and certainly in the present moment for Muslim service women and men, that is one of the contexts in which their service is profoundly important and often profoundly challenging. However, that history isn't just specific to Muslim service women and service men. It also, in the case, for example, of World War II, has links to the oppression that Buddhist service folks faced, and earlier sometimes Catholic service folks. So this story of the ways that religion, race, and ethnicity intersect together with the bedrock question of who serves in the United States Armed Forces is crucial, and again, has a deep history. Let me give you one more example. And this one perhaps is more unexpected unless you've been wise enough to take history classes here at the University of Utah. That's the case of European immigrants themselves. And here I'm speaking about the immigrants that came into the United States in very large numbers, starting in the 1880s and through World War I. Immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe primarily, and prior to them, Irish immigrants, faced enormous hostility in the United States, and yet they served in very large numbers. Those immigrants found themselves categorized technically through policy by our government as enemy aliens, both in World War I and in World War II. Now, of course, it's Japanese Americans who are the most famous example of enemy aliens, but I do want you to get a sense that the historic specificity of race and the historic specificity of discrimination in the United States is critical to understanding both how the government and society has made the life of some military folks challenging, and also how those military folks have resisted that, how they fought back to show their patriotism and to show a deeper, more profound understanding of the values that are at the heart of our nation. In the case of World War I, just to give you some sense of this, this was an international story, as it often is. The response of towards supposed enemy aliens. During World War I, there were several sites in the United States that were used to inter these so-called dangerous enemy aliens, especially Germans. One of those sites you might know is right here in our own backyard, and that's at Fort Douglas. Fort Douglas is an incredibly important part of this story and of the trajectory of the oppression that unexpected minorities have faced in the United States as they've tried to serve in the military. By 1910, immigrants accounted for 15% of the United States population. Today, that number, thereabouts, is about 13%. So not really that different of a number. In the World War I Army, fully 18% of the total U.S. military service folks were from 46 different countries. They were immigrants. So we have a deep and long history of immigrant patriotism in the United States. You know the World War II story, but you might not know that both Italians and German Americans were deemed enemy aliens, and that many, many served in uniform. Of course, as I noted earlier, the most powerful story of that service in the face of discrimination is by Japanese Americans, and the story that best represents that is the service of the 442nd Combat Regiment team. Okay, that's a little bit of history for you, and we could keep on going with Vietnam and the Gulf Wars, but I want to go ahead and skip ahead to the contemporary moment and start chatting with our guests here to dig in a little bit more deeply about military experience and what it means to be a veteran from communities that often find themselves marginalized. So I'm going to start with Singh and ask you to say a little bit about why you went into the military and what your experience was during the military, and also tell us where you served when you were in, please.
Thanks. Yeah. My family, you know, I'm from India originally, and my family has a long history in serving in the military. I still have uncles that serve in the Indian Army, and my grandfather served in the Royal Indian Army, which was the British Indian Army in the Second World War. And being a minority, even in India, we were a minority, and then because I belong to Sikh faith. And there was in the 80s, you know, there was in the early 90s, it was a lot of the Sikhs weren't the most popular in India. Let's just say that. So my dad decided to, you know, relocate us to or migrate to U.S. because he didn't see the future, you know, safe and secure future for the Sikhs. So that was I came here when I was in ninth grade in high school. And it felt great to be in a place where, you know, you get so many opportunities and you're not, your life is not in danger just because you're different ethnicity or different, you look different. So it was for my way of, like, you know, giving back. At that time, you know, in high school I always believed, in a lot of countries there's, everybody serves their, does some kind of service for 2 years or serves in the military or, you know, and I kind of have that mentality, and I'm like, I need to give back or serve, you know, for the opportunities that I do have here. So that's kind of the reason I
say more about that. Say just a little bit more about when you went in, what specialty you had, and when you got out.
Right, so I joined 2001. I graduated high school 2001 in June, and I was in infantry basic training, because I was another reason I went to infantry, because I was not a citizen, so I couldn't get clearance for majority of the job. It was either a tanker, infantry, or cook. So I picked infantry because that's what my recruiter was. And but I was September 11. I was in basic training, and we were a month out from graduation. And that day, how the training went on after that kind of changed. The mood changed because we knew now, like, after graduating, we'll be getting deployed soon. And from there, I was stationed in Germany with the 1-4 Cav. And from there, we went in 2004. We got deployed to near Tikrit and Samarra. There's a small town called Adar, and it's actually the same town where Saddam Hussein was captured in that spider hole. So we got there a month after he was captured. So we would get a lot of high-ranking officials flying just to see that see this spot, but. I mean, I feel like overall, my experience was positive. You know, I feel probably more of a the race, or I'm aware of my race more outside of the military. Seems like, because in the military, as you go through so many experiences. You know, when you're training and deployed, there's such a common shared experience that it kind of, you know, a lot of the barriers just melt away. But coming out, you're kind of, I felt more aware of it than in the military.
That's great. Thank you very much. Haseeb, would you mind telling us a little bit about your time in service so far and where you've been serving?
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Haseeb Hossein Zada. I'm a student at Westminster College. We're pretty much neighbors. Born and raised in Kabul, Afghanistan. Came here in the United States and back in 2011. I was 15 and I went to Wasatch Academy, if you're familiar with Utah. It's down south, it's in a tiny little town. And graduated in 2013 and got some a good scholarship at Westminster College, and I was. Do we have any international students in this right here? There you go. I was an international student back then, and F1 visa, and that's what I was on here. And by accident, I found out about the military. Specifically, there was this program that was launched back in 2008. It's called MAVNI, and what it stands for is Military Accession Vital to the National Interest. And it was aiming for students or legal immigrants who got to the U.S. legally and they had something to offer to the military. And me being from Afghanistan, so my language was the thing that they needed. And so I joined, and it was one of those things that I had to make a decision overnight, because coming from Afghanistan, as people in America say, you know, I come from the bottom. And so I wanted to have a better future like everybody else. And so I saw the military as a chance to do that. And mainly it was because of citizenship is what I joined, to be honest. And so I became a citizen. And currently I'm serving in the reserve, Army Reserve. And this is my third year in the Army. And I've had pretty good experience so far. I don't know, I look Asian so often when I tell people that I'm from Afghanistan, they question me. And I have to prove somehow that I'm from Afghanistan. But I am from Afghanistan. And if you don't know anything about Afghanistan, Afghanistan has a lot of ethnic groups. And I am a Shia. So there are Sunnis and Shias. And then there are tribal groups. I'm Hazara. And Hazara is the minority in Afghanistan. And we have Asian-looking features. And so that's why my ancestors go way back in Mongolia. Genghis Khan, if you know. And that's my experience so far. And the hardest experience that I had to go through was in basic training, pretty much, because I am a Muslim. I'm a Muslim and a practicing Muslim. One thing that I really learned early on was that in the military, people come from all over walks of life, and a lot of those people are from ages, let's say, 17 or 15 even. And so I kind of knew what to expect, because I had been asking around and then about the culture, because I wanted to go there and prepared. And so while at basic training, something that I always think about is that there is a mentality when kids join the army or the military in general, that we're gonna go and kill Muslims. That's what I heard. And so there was this kid at basic training that, like, dude, I cannot wait to go out in the world and start killing Muslim. And that kind of triggered something in my head. And I'm a very calm person, but at that moment, I just wanted to peacefully interact with that individual, why he had to say that. But like Singh said, other than that, I'm not being reminded daily that I am not an American in the military, as much as I think of me as a foreigner outside of the military, if that makes sense. But that is so far my experience.
Thank you very much.
Haseeb Hussein Zada is a student at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. He's an immigrant from Afghanistan and a practicing Muslim who currently serves in the U.S. Army. He spoke as part of a panel discussion about diversity in the U.S. military recorded last week. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are airing a forum about unexpected minorities serving in the U.S. Armed Forces in the past and currently today. The discussion is moderated by Professor Matt Basso. He's an associate professor of history and gender studies at the University of Utah. He's also the author of several books. Also part of the discussion is Sanu Bhatti. He is a computer science student at the University of Utah. He's an immigrant from India, and he served in the U.S. Infantry from 2001 to 2005. Also Hasib Hussein Zada, currently a student at Westminster College, an immigrant from Afghanistan and a practicing Muslim, and he currently serves in the U.S. Army. Also, Diane Akiyama. She is an assistant counsel with the U.S. Bar. Her father served in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II.
Diane, could you tell us a little bit about your father and the decision that he made, maybe a little bit about his history in camp to enter the military?
Sure. And I don't know, I'll just give a brief history.
Please.
About the Japanese-American experience during World War II. When Pearl Harbor broke out, there were some Japanese who were serving in the military, and they were discharged at that time as enemy aliens. And then there was a group in Hawaii that continued to volunteer and serve. Eventually, they convinced the Pentagon to let them serve as a volunteer unit, and they served in Europe, and they were the 100th Battalion. After that, the military decided to increase the unit based on their service, and they formed a regiment. And at that time, many of the Japanese Americans on the West Coast had been evacuated to concentration camps inland or away from military establishments. So about 120,000 Japanese were interned in about 10 camps. Also, a lot of the immigrants, the main leaders of the community, had been interned in separate camps before that. So at the time the military decided to allow Japanese Americans to serve, a lot of the population were in camps at that time. So they originally asked for volunteers and sent out a questionnaire asking if they would be loyal to the U.S. and also if they were willing to serve and to forswear any allegiance to Japan. So there was a lot of tension in the community after this questionnaire, where people were willing to serve, but they wanted to serve only if they were released from the camps. At that time, there were other people who wanted to serve in camp, volunteer, whether or not just to prove mostly their loyalty to the U.S. and to show that they were American. And so out of originally with the 100th Battalion, the U.S. recruited Japanese who were willing to volunteer, and they formed up the 442nd. So they had a regiment which the 100th Battalion became a part of called the 442nd. And they served mainly in Europe. At that time also, the military was looking for translators to help decode Japanese communications in the Pacific. And at that time, they formed the Military Intelligence Service. So some Japanese were recruited for that station, and they eventually, the MIS becomes part of the CIA. But at that time, it was a language school, and they were recruited to serve in the Pacific to help translate for the Navy in those regions. The original MIS veterans, I think the original class was like 8 or 10 people, and they would actually travel into the combat zones with a Caucasian-looking buddy, I guess, so they didn't get shot, and they would translate and help decode and interrogate prisoners and helped in the Pacific theater. So most Japanese Americans served in Europe, but there were a large number that also served in the Pacific. After the war, they were served as translators in Japan and other places. My father's personal history, he was not one of the group that volunteered. He was in camp in Idaho in the Minidoka Relocation Center, and he was drafted after Based on the performance of the volunteers in Europe, the military decided to draft the Japanese Americans. So many of them were actually drafted out of camp. And so he was in the second group, luckily, because most of the first group were killed. But he served in Europe, in France and Germany, or France and Italy, sorry, primarily in Italy.
Thank you very much. I'm going to ask you to hold on to the microphone for just a second and maybe speak a little bit from what you know about the tensions within both the Nisei and Issei communities over service in the U.S. military since, in fact, they had been interned, put in concentration camps. What did your dad talk about? What did he say about the sensibility among the Japanese and Japanese American community about military service?
I think you have to think about the ages of everyone involved at the time. Usually, because of the way the immigration laws were set up, most Japanese immigrated to the U.S. in the early 1900s, and the immigration flow was cut off around 1928. After that, they were not permitted to come. So most of the Issei, the first generation, the immigrant generation, at the time of internment, they were probably in their late 40s to 60s. So they were people who had lost everything and were kind of looking to retire. The Nisei, the second generation, I guess the first American-born generation, they were primarily younger, so maybe early 20s to babies. But the Nisei felt that America was their home, most of them. And they wanted to serve to prove they were American. This was the age of the melting pot. They strongly believed in that. But in that, those general groups, there were also variances. There were a lot of Issei who wanted their sons to serve. Mm-hmm. They felt strongly they were American. This was the country they chose. At the same time, there were many Nisei who did not want to serve, mm-hmm. and were very upset about it. There was in one of the camps in Wyoming, there was a large draft-resisting group who strongly protested the draft because they felt they would serve if they were not in camp, if the country would allow their parents to be released from camp, then they would volunteer. So there was a lot of tension. My father, he didn't volunteer, I think partially because he was upset about the camps. If they had released everyone from camp, he felt then it would be okay. I think his parents also felt like, you know, you have to do what you have to do. This is your country. You should serve if you're drafted. But I don't think they wanted him to volunteer for that. Like any parents, they don't want their sons to go off to war. So there was a lot of variance in that, but the people who did volunteer, given the casualty rate was fairly high for the 442, they had about 18,000 people who served, and about 8,000 of those were either killed in action or missing. So it was a very high mortality rate, and the most of the ones that volunteered were killed in action or injured at least.
Right, thank you very much. The context of here, of course, is of an army, a military that was drafted versus an all-volunteer force, right? And that structural difference, I think, is really quite important to this story. For many immigrants during World War II, there was a national campaign, an immigrants all campaign, Americans all campaign, that really was our best face forward, right? This sense in propaganda that we were this diverse, united country where everyone would step up and serve. But in fact, there's an enormous number of Americans that served during World War II that weren't initially super thrilled about that. They had families, they were getting decent paychecks, some of them had wives and kids, but this was a draft-based army that did in fact bring in a cross-section socioeconomically and racial ethnic cross-section into the military. Since the all-volunteer force after Vietnam, this has been perceived as, well, folks want to volunteer. And if they want to serve, that's great. We appreciate them. Thank you for your service, sort of thing. But there are other components to this. One is a perceived need by some communities to prove patriotism. Another is just the socioeconomic reality that the military can help you out with school and with other things, right? A third is the question of citizenship, which has been back in the news again, right? So these kind of questions about how communities and individuals make these decisions in regard to service are really quite challenging. Singh, could you talk a little bit about your parents and the community that they feel tied to and their sense of how to see service in the U.S. military?
For me, my mom and dad were both happy that I was serving. People are always surprised when they hear that even my mom was happy. Because we, even in India, in general, the community, our community has a long history of serving in military and conflicts, and being in U.S., as a community, we feel a lot safer, and than where we come from. So it's a great honor, even in the community, if anybody volunteers and serves in the U.S. military. So yeah, they were all really happy about that.
Thank you, Hasib. Could you speak to the same question? How does your community? How does your family? How do the folks that they spend time with think about service in the U.S. military?
So I'm the very first person in my family who went in this route, and it wasn't by choice, I would say. Kind of had to force myself in this because of economical situations, and there was nothing for me to go back to Afghanistan to. And looking around my international friends, and as they graduate, the first thing they worry about is, okay, I have to find a job within 6 months of graduating, because if not, then I'll have to go back to my country. And having been used to the lifestyle here, would I survive? Would I be able to find a job or not? And so I had to kind of manipulate my parents to letting me join through Skype. Can I join or not? The first question my mom was, she asked me was, are you going to kill people? And to be honest, I didn't know at the moment. And I was like, no, I'm not going to kill nobody. It's reserve. It's just 1 week a month. You go there and do your job and come back, go to school. And so a lot of people don't know in Afghanistan, even my closest family members, they don't know that I'm in the military, because one thing, it's for their safety, because if they were to post a picture of me from with a uniform and through social media, that could be troubling for them, and having my family over there, so their livelihood could be in danger. And so that's one reason. And Even my friends around here, actually, they don't know, because with reserve, how reserve works is, like, right now I have long hair, so I can't go to training like this, because you have to put on your PC on. And so kind of monthly I come out of this long hair, I'm like, okay, it's training time. That's when they ask, oh, you had the haircut, you cut your hair often. That's when, if it depends on if you're, like, close to the person, hey, I'm in the military, so I'm doing my training, and then often it becomes boring, because a lot of people ask the same question and then you have to kind of give the same answer. But the reaction, I don't even know how would my immediate family would react to me being in the army, because of, they might think I'm a traitor, but totally depends on the lens of view, how they look at it. And
Thank you.
That's Hasib Hussein Zada. He's an immigrant from Afghanistan, currently serving in the U.S. Army, and he's also a student at Westminster College in Salt Lake City. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the show, this discussion is about so-called unexpected minorities, men and women from ethnic or religious minority backgrounds who have served or are serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. This forum was held this past week at the University of Utah ahead of the Veterans Day weekend. The conversation was moderated by Matt Basso. He's an associate professor of history and gender studies. And also joining the conversation is Sanu Bhatti, a University of Utah student and an immigrant from India who served in the U.S. Infantry from 2001 to 2005. Also part of the conversation is Diane Akiyama. She spoke about her father, who served in the 442nd Japanese-American Regimental Combat Team during World War II. Also, Hasib Hussein Zada. He's an immigrant from Afghanistan and a practicing Muslim who currently serves in the U.S. Army. Here's Matt Basso continuing the conversation with Hasib Zada.
Could you speak a little bit about, maybe elaborate on what you noted earlier about, you know, some of the other soldiers you've met in the military and what they've said about either your faith or your country of origin or anything like that? What's your sense of how the military or within the military folks grapple with racial, ethnic difference and with a religious difference?
It totally is a mixed up feeling. For now, at the moment, the unit that I am attached to, it's 744 up in Ogden. And the people around me, they're pretty nice. They respect you. I don't know. There's almost a fear attached to it, knowing that you're from Afghanistan. And often I take it, depends on the mood. You're like, okay, well, I need to be treated like every other American. Please don't exclude me, even if you're just thinking about it. But then it makes sense. I put myself in their shoes. And then with Afghan war being the longest fought war the U.S. has been involved in, it does make sense. And then it really varies. And then having been only 3 years in the military, I haven't been exposed to a lot of that, and I've only heard about it, how Muslims are being treated or not. For example, there are a lot of curiosity, and then knowing that about Islam and then talking to a Muslim about his or her religion is entirely different because, for example, when I was in basic training on Sundays, we would get a couple hours so that people who wanted to go to church and practice their faith. And for us Muslim, there were a couple Muslim soldiers from India, from Pakistan, from Afghanistan. And for us, there weren't a lot of facilities for us to do our weekend prayers. And but they did really try hard to provide us with some translated versions of the Quran, and I was surprised, to be honest, because I didn't know that was provided, and so that was a huge shocker for me. But instead of not being able to go to the church because you needed a mosque, and there wasn't any mosque nearby, and so there was a room that was provided for us, and we were let alone to go in there, do our thing for a couple hours, and then once we came back, and there are a lot of curiosity around us from soldiers, so what do you guys do in there? And then but definitely so far it has been positive personally for me, and I'm pretty sure there has been mixed up feelings for other soldiers of Muslim faith.
Diane, could you speak a little bit about your dad's time in the military and what he said about his experience, how he was treated? Did he speak about that at all?
Mostly what I heard about the military from him was that it was unorganized or how how much you had to wait in line. But I think he felt like they were treated well. I get the sense that they did feel like they were put in harm's way a lot more than other units. There were talk about some that they were a suicide squadron. Mm-hmm. But from all the Japanese and American vets I've talked to, they all have positive experiences about it. They feel that their service was well appreciated and they would do it again, and they were right to choose to serve, whether it was volunteer or draft. They all strongly felt that they were American and that they had to defend their country, and that their service helped the Japanese American community in the long run, that the acceptance and maybe tone down some of the discrimination. So I think they all strongly felt that their service was needed and that they made the right choice.
So did they ever speak about the military as a colorblind institution, as a place in which racism didn't exist in comparison, for example, to their life after the military and how they might have been treated those following decades?
I don't think it was quite that way, although you have to remember this is 1940-something.
Sure.
It was a segregated army. Blacks did not serve with whites. It was they were in a segregated unit, and so I don't think they viewed it as colorblind, although they most of them trained in the South,
mm-hmm.
where they witnessed a lot of discrimination they had not been exposed to coming from the West Coast. That was the first time they experienced segregation. And there are stories where if they would see, for example, African-American GIs when they were off the post, and they were not being served at a bar or something, they would try and defend them to the establishment or whoever was running the establishment and insist that they be served also. You also hear stories where they face discrimination off-site, but I think for the most part they did not feel like they were being discriminated based on their race by the military in general or from other GIs if they were in uniform.
Thank you. Sing, you, in some ways, you prompted this question in my head, and I had noted it earlier in correspondence with you all. The military does have this reputation in some ways as a colorblind institution, right, as one of the few places perhaps that American values around a plural society actually mean something in a real day-to-day way. And you noted earlier that your experience with the military was that race seemed less relevant than it does in life outside of the military. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Right. And similar to what Diana said, that going from West Coast, going to Fort Benning, Georgia, for basic training, and it is in that within the U.S. that is a bit of a cultural, cultural shock. Because in growing up in or going to high school in California, you're less aware. And it was in actually it was in basic training. We did have kids from the South and the mountain ranges and East, and you kind of there was a lot of conflict, because then you have a lot of young kids there, 18, 19, 20, and they bring their experience in, and it does. I think that was probably the most where you're kind of aware of the race, the conflicts within races. But once I got to regular unit, and I was stationed in Germany, my experience could have been different if I was stationed, maybe in one of the southern states. I'm not sure. But I was stationed in Germany for 3 years, and it was obviously you don't get along with everybody, and if I felt like people didn't like me was because they didn't like me. I didn't feel that it was because of race or anything else. But other than, because you just have so much common, obstacles or hurdles you go through, that it kind of creates a bond. And even when you were talking about race and stuff, you almost, like you, you know, it's like, it's somebody's, this John or Michael or anybody, like it's the race, you don't think of race, you know, it's just a person. But being outside it, in California wasn't, I mean, even here it's not that bad, but the current culture itself has kind of, you know, when I see people walking around with, shirts like Make America Great, I mean, yeah, like, they really are sending some other message, it seems like. And I do want to talk to those people, like, hey, you know, you're just some, this kind of mentality is not going to get you anywhere. Or, you know, you're thinking very in a narrow way. But yeah, and that is kind of lately the atmosphere has like made me aware more of kind of race than, you know, let's say while I was in the military.
Thank you very much. So I want to make sure that I get to your questions. I realize that I've hogged the time quite a bit because I had a lot of questions for our excellent panel. Are there things you would like to ask them?
Hello, my name is Tanya. I'm a student here at the University of Utah. One of the panelists mentioned joining for economic reasons, and these days, just what I hear from people is that the financial incentive is a big reason people choose to join. And also, in your introduction, you mentioned that certain ethnicities are overrepresented within the service. And I'm wondering if any of you witnessed any sort of socioeconomic divide within the service, and whether and how that related to, I guess, more ethnic divide.
Thank you. Who wants to tackle that one?
Okay, so. Yeah, that was me that I said something about the economical reasons. So I kind of had to choose. I had two difficult options, basically: either join the army or go back to Afghanistan. And so I chose this one because. So one thing about Afghanistan, like I said, I came here when I was 15, about 7 years ago, and. So the day-to-day life in Afghanistan is basically, so if you're a parent, your kid is going to school in the morning, and you give the big goodbye kiss on the forehead, that is basically kind of like saying goodbye as well, because you're not sure whether your kid is coming back or not, and often that is the case. And so having those, contemplating those difficult situations, and then whether you want to put your parent in that mentality in that situation. And so as a kid, I had to make the choice. Okay, I go there, there's a higher chance of me, being one of those casualties. And instead I could join the U.S. military. I know it's not easy, but I could give it a try. And that's what I gave it a try, and it worked. And while being a basic training, I had to constantly give preach to myself in my head that, hey, okay, so you're here for one reason, and that is getting your citizenship and going back to Westminster College and get on that scholarship that they give you. And that's what I did, and it worked out. But for a lot of people, it didn't work out, because while you're joining as a MAVNI on this special program, it's because... how it works is basically the moment you sign the contract, you have no status. You're basically a person with no status at all. You don't have F1 visa. You're not a citizen yet, because your paperwork are being thrown around to see what is needed next. And so finally it worked out. I got my citizenship, but I still have, to be honest, I still have I'm not sure. It could be taken away from me. I don't know how it works with citizenships, to be honest. All I know is I have, and Obama signed on it. Okay, Hasib is a citizen from this day on. But it could be taken away. Looking at the current political climate, but basically what I joined for was that choosing between two hard decisions that I had in front of me.
Thank you. Would either of the other panelists like to comment at all about this question of socioeconomic status and military service?
It does, like you were saying earlier, that maybe with the volunteer military, it is you do see certain section of a community are overrepresented. So it's you do see a lot of people they serve because of they're in either in the parts of U.S. where there's not a lot of jobs or not a lot of opportunity. So military is a good way to kind of better yourself. And even for myself, it was coming from India, we didn't have much, so getting an opportunity to go to college using GI Bill is a representative of a good opportunity,
Thanks. I don't want to be overly glib, but we could have done a panel on the most unexpected minority in the military, at least in my experience, and that's the wealthy and well-connected who don't serve in too many numbers in the military. Sir?
My name is Mac Allred. I'm a veteran. I was a recruiter for a little while. And so to answer her question, I kind of wanted to speak to that for a second. What you see in the socioeconomic segregation is the tools that many of the people have learned in preparation for joining the military. I recruited out of LA. 76% of the population of LA isn't eligible to join the military. So those who were trying to usually escape something, and they just didn't have better tools. Many of them were still sending money home to pay for mortgages and rents and things of that nature. So what you saw was how the person had been prepared for adulthood in general hadn't been quite ingrained in them. And so the money they had was changing their life, but they didn't know how it was changing their life. They just knew they had more money than they usually had ever had. And so you could see the segregations in that, those who kind of came from a little more, or at least middle class, and those who came from the bottoms and the have-nots.
Mac, could you say just a little bit more before you give up the microphone about that other 76%? Was that because of age? What status made it so that they weren't going to be potential military enlistees?
Excuse me for my voice. I was at a Jay-Z concert the other night. So it was different things that were doing it. Many had criminal backgrounds, usually drug-related charges, weight, and an inability to actually pass the entrance exam, the ASVAB. So education was kind of a problem, and these were people who were indeed high school graduates. It's not just, there were dropouts, obviously, but there were high school graduates who could not pass the ASVAB. And so it was a multitude of reasons behind it, but ultimately it was just a limiting, like I said, it was a very limiting structure of people that just couldn't join. They were ineligible the day I said hello.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Yujin. I'm a student here at the U also. I was born and raised in Korea. I actually joined the Army Reserves almost 3 years ago, but I'm still waiting to ship out to basic. So, so I guess Pat, the recent 2 years, so there are people like me who are still waiting to ship out to basic training, and also there are people who already have been naturalized, and they're facing national origin discrimination from the DOD about not being able to pass the security clearance, so they're not able to advance in their military career. So what do you think this says about the Army as the sort of colorblind government entity?
Could you just say just a little bit more about why you're still waiting to ship out? I think I understood why, but could you say more specifically?
So I was supposed to, so for MAVNI applicants, they're supposed to wait for 6 months before they can ship out to basic. But shortly after I joined, there has been a lot of increased security measures, so-called. So there's this whole gridlock in the security clearance processes. So that's why.
Singh, do you want to comment on that, or see Diane?
Right. I think that's a good question. When we talk about, when I say like, you know, military is a, or army is a colorblind institution, I think it's a different experience once you're inside and you're with people, and it's just going to be, and you meet a lot of great people who do you know, work really hard and do a good job. And I think you're talking about the other thing is the structure that deals with kind of the outside, you know, the bureaucracy at a, like a higher level. I think that, you know, they have their reasons why they're blocking. But I think when we talk about, we don't mean that there's no discrimination, you know, in society or in general. But I think when you're with a group of unit, it's kind of different because it's not like going to job here where you see them for a couple hours and not on the weekends. In the military, it's like a lifestyle. You see the same people, you know, every day, and you pretty much do everything with them from work to hang out, you know, in the evening or go out on the weekends. So it creates that kind of bond where, you know, the everyday people you see is you don't really think of their race. But I could see as an institution and with, you know, DOD with the bureaucracy and all that, and you know, what can we say? The exact reasons, you know, that would be, I guess there's some discrimination in that sense of who they let in and not.
I guess I just want to say it is kind of sad if that's true, because I think service in the military in the 40s and the 50s opened up a lot of doors in America for people and different races and different colors and religion. Back then it used to be that if you were served in the military, you got the GI Bill, and you look at the children of the Japanese Americans who served, most of them have gone to college, whereas maybe their peers may have not have, and it really opened up a lot of doors for those people. It may be a sad state for our current society if we are going backwards from that, and hopefully that is not the trend.
Well, these last comments, I think, have really highlighted kind of the complexity and contradictions of this current moment, as well as the history of military service for communities of color, for communities that have felt marginalized over time. You know, it's still up to us, I think, as citizens, not just service members or those who have had family members as service members, to remember that we need to be activists. We need to speak to our lawmakers, and we need to talk about the policies that we're talking about here, because they do constantly shape the experience of folks who want to get into the military and the experience of folks who are actually in the military, right? That relationship is not hermetically sealed off. The military does reflect society as it currently stands, and sometimes it's at its best, sometimes it's not, but nonetheless, the takeaway point, I think, for me, is just the remarkable service that communities of color, that minority communities, that religious minority communities have done for the United States, even during incredibly difficult times for themselves and their communities, when the United States might not be as welcoming as it should be. So I believe we're out of time. So I want to take one final moment to thank our panelists again and to thank you all for joining us in this conversation.
This has been a forum about diversity in the U.S. Armed Forces and the history and the current experiences of, quote, unexpected minorities serving in America's military. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.